Welcome to Night School. I'm Becca.
And I'm Claire. We're a student-run podcast bringing you monthly doses of the medieval world.
Today we are joined by Dr. Stephen Murray to discuss medieval European Gothic architecture, specifically the Notre Dame of Amiens, which is the subject of his latest book.
Stephen Murray is the Lisa and Bernard Sells Professor Emeritus of Medieval Art at Columbia University. He was educated at Keble College, Oxford, and the University of London. His teaching career spanned 5 decades. He held positions at Morley College, University of London, Indiana University, Harvard University, and Columbia University since 1986. His field of teaching includes Romanesque and Gothic art, particularly involving the integrated understanding of art and architecture within a broader framework of economic and cultural history. At Columbia, he established and directed the Media Center for Art History and served as a departmental chair. His publications include books on cathedrals of Amiens, Beauvais, and Troyes, as well as books on medieval preaching and the role of storytelling and plotting in the comprehension of Gothic. His current book, Notre Dame of Amiens, The Life of the Gothic Cathedral, published by Columbia University Press, appeared in December 2020. Murray, a former Guggenheim Fellow, holds honorary citizenship of Amiens and an honorary doctorate from the University of Picardy, Jules Verne, and Amiens. Thank you so much, Dr. Murray, for joining us today. So in the opening of your book, you describe the cathedral as an, quote, overwhelming masterpiece that appears to link human creativity with the divine. Tell us about the first time you visited the cathedral and why it particularly struck you. Mm-hmm. And then also we kind of just wanted to know what differentiates architecturally Notre Dame of Amiens from other Gothic cathedrals of its time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's a pleasure to go back to Amiens in my mind. And the very first time I went there, I remember, was in 1969. And it happened to be exactly 50 years before the ceremony I mentioned to you, which was an honorary doctorate at the University of Picardy, which commemorated the 50-year anniversary of the university. So 50 years of knowing Amiens. I went first with a visit by the Courtauld Institute of Art in London. And we were a group of graduate students led by my teacher, Peter Kidson. And we had a little minivan and we filled it with our students and we drove around France. At Easter time, it snowed, I remember. It was terribly cold. And a friend and I, Roger Stanley and I, stayed in the youth hostel just across the River Somme from the cathedral, lovely view across the building. And we had a seminar in the building with Peter Kidson. That was the first time I saw it. But I got to know it subsequently like that. I don't know if you can see this image, but I was a motorcyclist. And that is me setting off on my motorcycle from England to go to France. I loved France much more than I loved England. And crossing the channel generations of English people before, we look for the first friendly town to stay in. And Amiens is, in a sense, an English town because it's full of English people. It's very convenient. So I took to going there a great deal. I just got to know the building and was drawn to it for those kind of almost accidental reasons. But then you ask, what makes it attractive? What makes it unforgettable, in fact? And I started to try and jot down two or three concepts. It just feels right. The famous architectural critic, Villiers le Duc, the French historian of the 19th century, said, you know, when you go into Amiens, you just feel as if you can breathe for the first time. You take lungs full of air. It just feels right. So then why does it just feel right? And I would say it's a combination of spaciousness that a Gothic cathedral is all about space. And at Amiens, they realized, as they did at Bourges, that spaciousness is more immediately effective the closer it is to you. So that whereas at Chartres Cathedral and at Reims Cathedral and at Soissons Cathedral, they have an enormous upper window, the clerestory window is absolutely huge, whereas the arcade, the lower level of arches, is relatively cramped. Amiens does the opposite. It makes a huge arcade, so you go into this very spacious and you respond to that space. The clerestory is relatively smaller, but the whole elevation is divided by a great foliate band at the middle. And in my book, I deal a good deal with that foliate band, because it's at that level that the materiality and the solidity of the lower church, in a sense, dissolves into fantasy. The flowers come into bloom, and then above that, the upper elevation kind of dissolves. It's just a mass of little shafts and capitals and large glass windows. So it's almost as if the building bursts to flower halfway up. And you really see it and sense it at that proportion. So in other words, it's both very light in terms of structure, very light in terms of physical light, and it's skinny in the sense of being very thin. And the geometry, the essential geometry of the building, reveals itself in a very thin building. And very quickly, you start to reach for the geometric principles behind it, because you say to yourself, well, if I feel so good here, there must be something, there must be some reason for that feeling. And basically, it's a building which is designed around squares, and then playing around with perverting the square, altering it, changing it a little bit. It's a building that invites you to enter and move through. And as you move through, the upper part opens up for you, but also as you move down towards the choir, the whole building kind of explodes spatially. The bays become slightly wider, the building transforms itself, and then you find yourself in the choir, or towards the choir, where all the kind of horizontal, receding, orthogonal lines are tilted upwards, and suddenly the hemicycle, which is very open and spacious, in a sense, it's as if the building is taking you from a horizontal experience of passage down the length into a vertical one where heaven and earth are linked. At the point of the principal altar, the point where the Eucharistic sacrament is sacrificed. Now, that's not just peculiar to Amiens, but because Amiens is so thin and skinny and the geometry is so palpable, somehow you're much more aware of it in that building.
Claire and I really enjoyed the beautiful photos of the cathedral in your book as well, but we'll definitely have to visit one day in person after the pandemic. Another thing that you mentioned early on in your book is how the mythology of St. Firmin the Martyr played a pivotal role in the founding of the cathedral. So could you kind of share this story with our listeners to provide a little more context?
Yes, well, the mythology of the patron saint of the church. Originally, the cathedral complex at Amiens was associated with St. Firmin and the Virgin Mary. Increasingly, with the construction of the Gothic cathedral, St. Firmin is a little bit pushed to the side, but he always remains one of the kind of pivots of devotion and liturgical practice at Amiens. So why St. Firmin, and what's the significance of all this? And I would say that there are two aspects. One is the universal need of Christians to find their roots and to tell their story of their roots and to have physical contact with their roots. So the idea of actually having a presence in the cathedral, an alleged body of the saint who had a lineage right back to the apostolic church, was seductive, irresistible. So St. Firmin was a Spanish figure from Pamplona. He'd been converted and baptized by St. Saturninus of Toulouse, Bishop of Toulouse. Now, Saturninus, according to the story, was an apostolic follower. He was present at the Last Supper, allegedly. So, in other words, you have a local man who has come from the south, who becomes a sign of local identity, who is physically present in the building. All that, I think, is irresistible. And it was all created as a set of stories, probably in the 8th or 9th centuries. We have no written sources going back. The life of St. Firmin, we don't even know exactly when that was, but as far as you can figure it out, it ought to have been in the 200s and belonged to the period of persecution of saints. And there is a kind of topos, a kind of repeated myth of saints, in which somebody comes from outside, brings Christianity to a population center, is welcomed by the populace, who baptizes, who preaches, who's enormously successful, and then the Roman governor becomes jealous, is suspicious and wary, and secretly has the person imprisoned and has their head chopped off. They are then taken to a burial site, a necropolis, which characteristically in Roman cities, you know, would not be within the city walls. It would be a necropolis outside somewhere, and would be put in a burial place out there. And these burial places, with the confusion of the Germanic invasions, were lost. And then you need a miracle of some kind, a miracle to reveal the location of that burial place. It's like Santiago de Compostela, the field of the stars, you know, where a star leads you to a place. It's like the three magi who follow the star. So the story is that the bishop, whose name was Sauve, or Salvius, was led by a light to the place where St. Firmin was buried, and he started to dig, and a suave odor came out of the ground, and the body was found miraculously intact. It was a cold January day, and miraculously, the cold day turned into spring or summer. The flowers came into bloom, the trees put on leaves, and the odor spread all the way through the diocese and beyond, and people were attracted, and they all came out and followed the procession back into the city. Sick people were healed, little boys climbed trees and threw palm fronds on the ground, and the cry went up, Hosanna, Hosanna. So it turns into a kind of triumphal Christ into Jerusalem. So Amiens becomes Jerusalem in a sense, and the bishop becomes Christ. And there he is placed in the cathedral as a center of devotion. But that's universal, that story. Different forms of it come up in so many different locations. But then there's a local issue. That locally you need some kind of sense of Christian local identity. And the whole notion of flowers and blooming, in a sense, becomes almost a kind of a sign. I mean, quite literally, it's the insignia of Amiens has a little foliate plant on it. So it becomes a local sign, and it gives Amiens something special. And you're dealing with rivalry between different holy sites, and Firmin was held up as being, you know, a very powerful saint worth visiting. It becomes a pilgrimage center. The mystery of the thing, which I touch on in my book, is actually, we know nothing about Firmin. Frankly, a lot of it is invented. But Amiens really was the place where the most famous, the mega saint of early Christianity in Gaul, actually was baptized. And I'm talking about St. Martin. St. Martin had the miracle of meeting the beggar outside the gate. That was Amiens. So, and you know, he recognizes the beggar as Christ and clothes him. And Christ appears to him later and says, you clothed me as you were supposed to. That happened in Amiens. Now, why didn't they take that as their leading legend? I have to leave it as a mystery. The only solution I can offer is that maybe the identity of Martin was so associated with Tours at the point that they felt they couldn't challenge that.
That was a wonderful picture that you painted of the miracle. I felt like I was watching it in my mind, like so vividly. But thank you so much for that.
It's in the tympanum at the portal on the left-hand side. The whole story is told. If you go to the website, you'll find it. The website is zoomable. I'm afraid the images are in the book. I'm very happy with the book, but I have to confess the images are not as sharp as I'd hoped them to be. But go to the website and there you'll find the story told with zoomifiable images.
I definitely will check that out after this. For our next question, this is something that I was really interested in that you mentioned in your book. You explained that the lay people were probably always permitted to ascend the two western towers of the cathedral, but the higher parts of the cathedral were only permitted access to the privileged few. And so we kind of wanted to know if you could briefly outline the process of physical ascension in the cathedral.
Sure.
Kind of explain how the architecture will slowly give people who are ascending, like a sense of the sublime, as you put it?
Well, I realized when I thought about that question that I'm conflating a little bit the past and the present. The privileged few are not upper class people from the Middle Ages I'm referring to, aristocrats or higher level bourgeois. I'm talking, using privileged few as a professional term, to describe those who managed to get to the upper parts of the building. And if you want to do that, and you just go to Amiens and say, I want to climb into the Triforium, likely is they'll refuse. You will not be allowed to do it. You can only, you're privileged if you've taken the care to write a letter to the local authorities to explain your mission, why you need to get up into the upper parts, to follow up then with a visit to the local direction of cultural affairs, persuade them that you're serious. Then you've got to get to know the local clergy if you can. It takes a lot of effort to have the privilege of being granted the ability to move around the upper part. That's what I meant by the privileged few. And at Amiens, I've been going to that city for so long. I'm a citizen of the city, actually, and a doctoral person from the university. So I'm privileged in that sense. They give me the key. And it's one of the greatest joys of my life is to go up there and look at those familiar places. So then what about the business of climbing? Anybody can go in at a designated time and enter the Western Towers, and there's a big broad staircase that's and somebody ahead of you is counting the steps and up and up and up and up. You go. But then there are, I think, about six other hidden staircases, which the ordinary visitor doesn't even know they're there. And the staircase that is normally used, which I normally use, is in the chapel, just to the east of the south transept. The chapel is dedicated to the conversion of St. Paul. And I love to think, you ask about the process of ascent, I love to think about the story of St. Paul, in which, do you remember, he goes blind and then is converted through a sort of miraculous restoration of his sight. And now exactly that is going to happen to you as you enter the staircase of that turret in the Chapel of St. Paul. You'll find online on the website, I actually did a video of climbing the stairs. So you're going round and round, it's dark and echoing and somewhat scary. And then suddenly you pop out into the triforium. That's the middle level. Now the triforium is exactly halfway up the building. Precisely, it's 21 meters down to the floor. Another 21 meters will take you up to the keystone. And so exactly halfway up, you have a view of the building where the orthogonal lines are actually parallel. From the ground, everything is receding. And you could feel a bit nauseous with the building doing that, you know. But then you see it like this, but somehow the geometry begins to become clearer to you. There's a sense of elation, a sense of joy, which I certainly feel when I'm up there. And medieval people did too. The Pilgrim's Guide to Santiago de Compostela, the writer of the guide describes the gallery of the Cathedral of Santiago. And he says basically, if you are unhappy and gloomy and sad, as you enter the building, climb into the gallery, and there you will feel joyful and elated. And it's true, it has that effect, that deep psychological effect. Abbot Suger, the abbot of Saint-Denis, describes liturgy in the upper space, halfway up the building in the western frontispiece of his abbey church of Saint-Denis. And he describes it as being neither in the purity of heaven nor in the slime of the earth. I love that. You're not quite in heaven, and you're certainly not on earth. And there's a kind of sense of seclusion and holiness. It's a place of angels, essentially. The last chapter of my book is called Angels in the Architecture, and it has very much to do with the church as a mechanism for creating heaven on earth. And you need a middle level, that's where the angels are. And indeed at Amiens, you'll find a lot of angels up there.
So you previously mentioned how St. Firmin's story appears on one of the main portals of the cathedral. And in chapter 2 of your book, you explore other portals and figurines further and kind of discuss their biblical significance. One that you mentioned is the statuettes of the Magi and the Virgin Mary in the south portal, which you explain were taken from Constantinople as part of a crusader siege in 1204 CE. So we were wondering, could you discuss where else in the cathedral we might see Byzantine art and how medieval Latin Christians at the time might have perceived these seized objects in the French cathedral, or just kind of contextualizing their political significance?
Certainly, you're talking about the right-hand portal. The three portals of Amiens make a kind of sermon, as I explain in the book. The center portal is the last, so-called Last Judgment. I call it the portal of the triumphant Christ. The left-hand portal is the portal of the Saint Fermin that we discussed. The right-hand portal is the portal of the Mother of God. Not the, la Mère de Dieu, they call it locally la Mère Dieu. And it's a translation of Theotokos. Theotokos is a Byzantine term for the Mother of God. And indeed, the form of the central figure, the Trumo figure, it wasn't physically stolen from Constantinople, but it mirrors the form of an ivory, a Hodegetria figurine, such as they have in the Metropolitan Museum in New York and across the world. It characteristically would represent that kind of image, the Mother of God. Similarly, the Magi on our left, who are approaching the Mother of God and offering their gifts, the figures themselves, they're locally carved, but the whole veneration of the Magi and the emphasis on Epiphany is an Eastern phenomenon. So the idea was imported. What was physically brought from Constantinople to Amiens in 1204 was, it's not the head of John Baptist, it's the face of John Baptist, it's the first, the front part of the face. It's a skull in a crystal covering with a golden mounting on a plate, on a golden plate. And it was stolen, it was pilfered, it was taken from the city, from Constantinople in 1204, and brought to Amiens by a clergy, member of the clergy from a local collegiate church at Piquigny nearby, and he gives it to the cathedral. It becomes the principal relic, certainly attracting quite a pilgrimage cult. So that is the physical object that is purloined, if you like. Then what is the implication of Byzantine art more generally? I would say that Byzantine art comes into Italy, above all in the form of mosaics. And it's not just Constantinople that they look to, that the builders of and decorators of Amiens Cathedral, they look to Ravenna, the Italo-Byzantine mosaics of the great churches of Ravenna, and they look to Rome. And I would want to say that the brightly painted sculptural program of Amiens, it was all brightly painted, would above all evoke mosaics. And in the background, behind the three-dimensional figures, it is a decorative pattern that was called la mosaïque in some of the older sources. They deliberately wanted you to think that there are mosaics behind the figures. So sometimes when I was a teacher, I used to tell my students not to talk about painted sculpture, but to talk about lumpy painting. In other words, talk about three-dimensional painting, which is what it is. You know, it really should be thought of as painting. That's one concern. Another would be to look at and think about the stained glass, the great expanses of stained glass windows, as a kind of transparent, translucent mosaic. Byzantine churches have their effect through light reflected off glittering surfaces. Gothic churches have their effect through light penetrating through a membrane, a colored membrane. And the glass at Amiens, sadly, is a lot of it is gone. And the brightness of the interior is largely because it was replaced with modern clear glass. But originally there was glass, stained glass everywhere. And that would have been a kind of translucent mosaic. And then lastly, in terms of Byzantine art in the cathedral, I would say that the whole emphasis on the liturgy of the Virgin Mary is a Byzantine phenomenon. The Feast of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, which I think is August 15th, that was imported from Byzantine liturgy. And in an account of the liturgy at Amiens that I read from the 18th century, local people thought that the whole singing of the Psalms, which was essentially the divine office, was something that was imported from the East. So all that would have been considered Eastern. The East was seen as the distant source, obviously, of Christianity. The clergy thought of themselves as apostles. And Amiens, the cathedral, is a kind of New Jerusalem. As we saw, when the relics come in to the city, it is a kind of triumphal entry into Jerusalem. So these are mechanisms to transform a local French city in northern France into Jerusalem, and the clergy from being local boys into apostles.
So I'm always interested in the next question I'm about to ask whenever we are talking about or thinking about architecture. So by the 15th century, you note that the entire structure of the cathedral was in dire need of refurbishment because alarming symptoms of collapse could no longer be ignored by that time. And we were curious to know what some of the problems were with the structure and kind of the solutions that were put in place to combat collapse. And we just kind of wanted to know how the canons maintained like the upkeep in general of the cathedral, because it's always fascinating to me how much effort goes into preserving old architecture like this.
I thought a lot about the structural issues, obviously, at Amiens, and the nature of my answer would be similar to the one about the local saint. There are universal issues in this new form of architecture that we call Gothic, but then there are the local results of peculiar choices that were taken in this building. And actually, when structural deformation begins to show itself, it's nearly always local problems. For example, at Beauvais Cathedral, I was able to demonstrate exactly why that cathedral collapsed in 1284. Even the precise point of the building that failed, and it was a local problem. The building was skewed. You had a very large bay that actually was skewed. It wasn't properly aligned. And one side of the bay was far too big. And that's what came down in the famous collapse. Now, all Gothic buildings push the edge of stability in terms of putting an arch over a rather slender support. Now, all arches want to push outwards. Pointed arches push out less than round arches. But when you've got a series of arches in an arcade, one arch will push against its neighbor and it'll be stable. What the real danger is comes from the presence of a transept, where the body of the building is intersected by a cross arm, and there the regularity of the arcade is interrupted. And at the crossing piers that define the square of the crossing, you've got an arch that's pushing against the crossing pier without anything much on the other side to support it. So that then is made worse at Amiens, because that particular bay on all sides of the crossing is enlarged. The builders, we know who the architect was, Robert of Lesage, must have chatted with the clergy. The dean was, his name was Jean d'Abbeville, and the dean and the bishop must have said, we want to have a building where the crossing space opens out and where the lay folk gather into a kind of spatial explosion that is a sublime experience. So Robert of Lesage says, yes, I can do that. I'll make that bay a little larger. But of course, the larger bay gives a bigger arch with a bigger push. And the supports at Amiens are slender. The arcade wall is relatively thick. So that way, the crossing arch is pushed inwards. But then, in the upper part, the vaults are pushing outwards. So cathedrals in the crossing have a banana configuration. They're bowed. And this is not just Amiens. This is the famous Wells in England. Did you go to Wells Cathedral down in the southwest? There, the crossing piers started to fail, and they put the famous strain arch in, a great big retaining arch inserted inside the crossing. At Amiens, they decided not to put the arch inside the crossing, but they put a chain along the length of the building to hold the piers and to prevent them from buckling. So that's the principal problem that becomes manifest in the 1470s or so. But then there's more than that. The upper choir is starting to buckle outwards, because the flying buttresses have been placed too high. The flying buttresses are butting against the upper building, and they're a little bit too high to support the vaults. And the whole eastern bay, I'm sorry, the western bays of the choir, the aisles are beginning to, the vaults are beginning to disintegrate. So it wasn't one, it was several different things. And fortunately, there was a visionary dean in place whose name was Adrien de Henencourt, who had a gifted architect whose name was Pierre Tachizel. And so they went about installing the great chain. Imagine, in fact, when you say the chain, there were eight chains, two in the nave, two in the choir, and two in each transept valve, running the entire length of the building, all made of iron. Iron that must have been hammered in a hydraulic forge using the mills of Amiens. And similarly, the upper choir was rebuilt under Pierre Tachizel. So this is a major, major thing, which kind of marks the end almost the end of the life of the cathedral. As you saw in the book, I want you to think of the cathedral, the Gothic cathedral, as having a life of 300 years. And towards the end, it reaches this crescendo of activity, which reaches a complete crescendo with the collapse of the crossing tower. It catches fire in 1528 and comes down just like Notre Dame of Paris. The merciful thing at Amiens is it was just the spire. In Paris, as you know, the tragedy was that they couldn't separate the spire from the rest of the roof. The roof was precious because at Paris, that's the original roof. To see that go was a heartbreaking thing, you know. But at Amiens, the spire went down and was rebuilt, the Golden Steeple, it was called. And interestingly, when the Ile-le-Duc rebuilt the spire at Paris, he took Amiens as his model. So that the spire that just was destroyed 2 years ago at Paris, that was a copy of the spire that still exists at Amiens. So it makes an exciting sort of end of the story. It ends not with a whimper, but a bang, the life of the cathedral. And the bang happens just as Martin Luther is spreading, followers of Martin Luther are spreading doubts about the efficacy of the cult of saints, about the efficacy of the sacraments, about the validity of the clergy. So all this is happening just as that spire comes down.
Yes, and I love how you connect that to the historical context of the time. I think it's definitely symbolically very interesting. But as we kind of wrap up our episode, I know you've mentioned throughout your interactive website that goes along with the book. So we would love if you could share with our listeners kind of what inspired you to include this virtual component and how they can best use it. It's definitely great, especially now that everything's been virtual for a while, to kind of explore the cathedral in that way. So if you could just share a little bit about that.
I would put that question, I would answer that question in terms of a quest which I've pursued now, as I say, for 50 years or so, to try and get the cathedral into a book. And you know, cathedrals don't go in books. It doesn't work. This is the sixth time I've tried to do it. And similarly, as a teacher, one tries to get the cathedral into the classroom. And again, the cathedral doesn't easily come into the classroom. It's funny because art history teachers in my field will kind of unconsciously say, in the age of slides before the digital age, they would say the slide on the left is Chartres Cathedral, the slide on the right is Amiens Cathedral. And you'd want to say, what nonsense, that's the slide on the Amiens Cathedral is 3,000 miles away in France. You've just shown a translucent image on a piece of membrane. That's what you're talking about. So to try and get the cathedral into the classroom, you need more than slides. And the challenge at Columbia when I came in 1986 was that we have the core curriculum. And the core curriculum is a fabulous idea in which all undergraduates are required to take a course in philosophy, a course in music, a course in art history, and it gives you a captive audience. You know, so we fill our classrooms. We do it in small sections of 25 or so. We don't have a single big classroom. But because Amiens was the monument that was chosen to represent 1,000 years of artistic production in the Middle Ages, I felt it my job to make that cathedral so completely compelling that nobody could really neglect it. And I've got to tell you also, in the discipline itself of art history was profoundly troubled in the 1980s. And the theoretical term was having its impact, and students were increasingly not wanting to study the work of art, but go and become a philosopher and read their French deconstruction texts and philosophize. And I wanted to persuade my student that the work of art is still there, it's still worth looking at. Just look at it, it's irresistible. So I started mucking around with animations, and I got a grant from the NEH to do an animation on Amiens. And we did it back in 1995. You can still find it, still on YouTube. It's called the Amiens Trilogy. There were three parts originally, although one was a digital disc, which no longer works. But the Amiens Trilogy was done with a very early animation, three-dimensional modeling application called Softimage. And it really made a sensation. It actually went to the Montreal Film Festival. and it attracted a lot of attention. So then NEH was so pleased with this that they gave me a so-called challenge grant worth millions. And with the challenge grant, we set up the Media Center for Art History at Columbia University, which still operates. And I was the first director of the Media Center for Art History. And I was going to use that facility to really try and spread the idea of digital animations, images, high resolution images across the spectrum of teaching the core curriculum. And quite frankly, I didn't altogether succeed in doing that. But the AMIA animation certainly was one of the great achievements of that phase. So that's what gave me the idea of animations. But what I realized is that digital media is extremely ephemeral. You can set something up, and within 5 years, you'll find the technology is obsolete unless somebody is constantly updating and debugging and so on. So for some years, I was putting all my scholarly efforts into digital technology. We did a databasing project on Romanesque architecture for 6 years. I'd go with groups of students with digital cameras and laser measuring devices and so on, to gather Romanesque churches into a website. And then beyond that, I did the Mapping Gothic France website, where we gathered cathedrals into a website. But then I realized that the maintenance of those sites was not being looked after, and that within a certain limited number of years, they would become obsolete. So I decided to put all my efforts for my last project into the book. The book will sit on your library shelf, it won't go obsolete, it won't go buggy. And luckily, the website attached to it is being maintained, because it is part of the core curriculum at Columbia, and I think it will go on being maintained. What does the digital media, what does the website do that you cannot do in the pages of a book? I would say probably three things. It gives you the ability to animate the work of art, so that the construction of the building on the website, you can see the building going up. And we've done a similar thing for Notre Dame of Paris, which is attracting a lot of attention. The construction of Notre Dame of Paris is quite complex. And to see it in a simple SketchUp animation, it's a very, very easy way for the audience to understand that complexity. So animation, music — you can't put music in your book. And you'll find on the website that we actually had the enormous privilege of being able to record music in the cathedral. And we spent a whole night in September of, I guess it was 2018, recording 5 medieval pieces. And I had 3 microphones set down the length of the building. So you can move through the building and experience the music at all different places. And it's quite spectacular. You know, if you think lay people were excluded from the liturgy, just listen to that music as you enter the building. It fills the building already. There's no way lay people wouldn't be involved in that. As you approach, certainly as you reach the crossing space, it becomes sublime. It really begins to come together very beautifully. As you continue into the choir, right up where the singers are, it becomes too — you hear too much. So the building, in a sense, receives the music. The building is itself a musical instrument, and it performs best when you're in the middle. So music, animation, movement to track your own passage through the building. So that I begin the book with the visits, and I want you to come with me and look at this and look at that. What is art history, if not a kind of show and tell, to have an interlocutor walk through and say, look at this, and what about that? How should we describe this? And so the book allows me to do that, and the book allows me to tell stories a bit. So the combination of the website and the book, it's the best I can achieve at this point, I think. It would be nice to make a full movie on the building. So I'm a frustrated filmmaker. But, in fact, well, I am a filmmaker. I had 2 films at Montreal Film Festival. But my son is a Hollywood film editor, so in a sense, he realized what it was I was trying to do in the first place. Film ought to be the way to do it. Amadeus. Have you seen Amadeus, that movie? Oh, dear. If you want to know about Mozart, it's the best thing you could possibly do. So I dream of a film that unites space and sound and storytelling at AMIA. And one day before I'm done, perhaps, we'll see it.
That was all sounds really exciting. And we have a Twitter account for our podcast, so we will definitely share the link to the website whenever we release the episode, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got the link.
Okay, well, that was our last question. So we just wanted to say thank you again for joining us today, Dr. Murray. And for our listeners, stay tuned for future episodes, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much for the invitation.